Well, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Beata Chapman. Should have said that before I put the mic on. And I practiced at Santa Cruz for about 15 years, and this is my home temple. So I was invited to return and give this talk this evening about my recent experience with the transmission of the Dharma. And you know, my mind goes in so many directions with this, so many stories in it, you know, so many ways to talk about it. So I just kind of sat with that in preparing for this and this talk this evening and thought, you know, the most salient thing to me about the Dharma transmission experience, which was a 3-week process, which ended with a week with my teacher up at the Russian River Zendo, which are actually the formal, you know, sort of formal ceremonies. And I had no idea, you know, what this really, I mean, I'd seen Dogen's life, and I had, you know, a few words had been thrown around during my practice, but I really did not know what was going to happen per se. And I was a junior person to the other person there receiving transmission as well. So that was really, in many ways, wonderful, because I just followed her. What she did, I did. What she said to do, I did. And I just took all the responsibility off me for thinking, pretty much. And that was very, it was a relief. And I realized how much stress she was had because of it. And I still didn't take it back. So I had it was really a very sweet week of being taken care of by a lot of people, actually. I think the thing that really stays with me that just struck me so deeply during the process was this practice for 23 years has been really constantly reminding me that I am a beginner, that I'm at the beginning. And I realized during these very, you know, high church kind of voodoo-esque ceremonies that really is it. That really is the point of the whole thing. And for me, it just is, I realized probably for the first time that is such a beautiful gift to know that you're always a beginner. That in every moment, we're just a beginner, because every moment is new. If I receive it as the last moment or carry something over from the last moment, then I haven't received this moment fully. I've hindered it with a little tinge of the past, which of course I do a lot of that. And so so when I started practice, I used to think, oh, you know, they just keep saying you're always a beginner and I'm never going to get anywhere. And I had a lot of ideas about where I might get. So this morning I was on my email and I read an article that came across there about the 12 characteristics of enlightened people. And I thought, oh, you know, finally, they've come out with it. They've put it on paper. So I read this thing, and the more I read, the more despondent I became. I actually thought about scheduling a therapy appointment this afternoon. because I'm like, okay, number one, enlightened person is calm and equanimous. Well, occasionally. Number two, an enlightened person is always kind and generous. Well, occasionally, you know, I mean, I was going, and then finally, number 11, I resonated with number 11. It said, is devoted to practice. Okay. I think I have that one, you know. But again, what I got was, if I think I know what this thing is, it's not it. So, I mean, it was so interesting to me to see this thing written in, you know, blue, black, and white, and to put my own life and my own practice up against it and figure that out of the 12-point test, I got one, you know. Because for me, my actual experience, lived experience, is that it's just practice. That, in other words, enlightenment is not some sort of state of mind that once achieved is never changes. I mean, that would say that our whole teaching is inaccurate, because the whole teaching is everything changes. And so if we think, well, I can get to this place where I have these 12 characteristics and you can measure them and hold me up against other people and, you know, does she have 9? You know, how many do I have? And you can kind of, well, then we know. I mean, I got a lot less despondent when I realized that I don't believe that. That my actual experience isn't that. That these mind states that were described in these 12 characteristics all come and go through me. All the time. I recognize all of them. But I can't hold on to them. I can't claim some kind of stake in them. They are just passing energies. And maybe that's all there is. Maybe that's enough. So again, that article, which wanted to tell me about an end, just put me back at the beginning. Like, well, what is this? What do I mean by this? What's my actual experience with this? And so in thinking about that in relationship to the Dharma transmission ceremonies, I realized it's so subtle. What practice is, now I might cry, what practice is, what it brings forth is so subtle that I don't, it's, and, but so powerful at the same time. So the only thing I can do is give examples of this to try to convey it. You know, my teacher is Tony Patchell, and I became his student when Darlene Cohen died, and Darlene was his wife. And she had been my teacher for many years, several years, about 5 years. And she, you know, it was more or less determined that I would work with Tony, and at some point in the future he would give Dharma transmission to myself and one other person who Darlene had intended to transmit and died before she could. She ran out of energy to do it. So she gave us letters and asked Tony to carry this out. And that was about a little over 2 years ago. And, you know, Tony and Darlene are like day and night to each other. I mean, totally contrast, incredible contrast between these two people. And so it was a huge adjustment for me. And then, of course, I inherited him in the midst of his deep grief over losing his wife of 30-plus years. And just all the things that meant. So Tony is very subtle in how he communicates and how he does things. He's very quiet, very contained, and then he just does really subtle things. And so on the fifth or sixth night that we were there, I'm escorted up into this room that is all red silk, floor to ceiling. It was Darlene's office, and it was draped in these red silks from ceiling to floor. The doors were draped. Everything was draped. So the room was about the size of a postage stamp once all the shelves and desks and everything were hidden behind this billowing walls of red silk. And, you know, I was basically led through many, many activities in that room. Many things to do, complicated things, simple things, whatever. Just doing all these activities with 3 or 4 other people in this tiny room. And I was kneeling at one point in front of the table that was between Tony and I, and he was seated. And So there are these silks that are part of the process. And he had one of them laying on the table in front of me. And at some point in the ceremony, as part of the process, he picks this thing up. And when he picked it up, there was a little doily under it. And I just started to cry. I just saw this little doily, and it was Darlene's, you know, prized little thing, little doily about this big that she loved. And she would carry it around the house and always have it under her cup. And she just loved this little thing. And a little doily with embroidery, some kind of, I don't know, some kind of plant or embroidered. And he did this throughout the event. So there would just be little things. And you would go, oh. That would just take your breath away. So subtle. And it occurred to me later, days later, as I was thinking about, probably weeks later, as I was thinking about coming here, if I think that it is a fruit of practice that I can walk in a red room, completely red. I love red, and I was just taken by the silk and this whole Tony sitting there, you know, and but I could still notice that little doily. The little doily did not get swept away by the bigger, you know, grand things that were happening. And I love that about this practice. It's a beginning place. If I think, oh, it's the red room, and I know this, then, and that's the silk, and he, you know, I know what he's going to do, and I did, I might have missed that little precious doily there, missed its significance. I might have overlooked it. I was really struck after the fact, thinking back on it, at how many tiny little things like that were there that might have, that I think would have just flown by me. Not too long ago, but now we're very, you know, just struck me. So I think that this beginning is actually a great gift of practice, this knowing that we're always beginning. First of all, when we make mistakes, we're beginning. We can begin again. So if you're Doan and you ring the bell wrong, or you're coming in to give a talk and you do all your bows and you leave the Jiko standing at the altar holding incense like this, and you stand up and bell rings and you think, well, I'm supposed to turn around now, but I see that I didn't make my offering. You know, that is a beginning place right there. And then I went up and I made my offering and I told Nanette, I abandoned you. I made the offering. Came back around. Now, I really have never seen anybody walk from the altar to a seat. So as I got to the end of the bowing mat, oh, should I turn around, bow again to the altar? No, I already did that. So walk to the seat. Every one of those, a teeny tiny beginning, just a beginning. Every one of those little moments. So it was a mistake. I came in, I did my bows. Nanette knew it. She stood there calmly and just waited. And then, you know, I just did it and it was all fine. So it's. I think in the beginning of my practice, I would have been completely flustered by that. I wouldn't have known what to do. I probably would have talked to everybody because that's what I do when I get nervous. But I think just realizing, well, you know, it's okay. You're just a beginner at this. You're just beginning. Every moment, new beginning. To be here tonight, all new bunch of new people. You know, a lot of. It just feels new to me. And yet, outside, familiar noises, familiar sounds. I love this temple for being across the street from a school because you get such joyous sounds in here. And, of course, I take a lot of joy from the trash trucks that come on Wednesday morning. And, you know, so truthfully, after working with Darlene, I can find that almost anywhere. My point is that I think when you really know you're a beginner, then everything actually just works better. There's not, it's so what? So I did my bows first. So I got nervous about bowing with this. How am I going to do it? I mean, I have never handled one of these. And this is a teaching stick that I received after the ceremonies. And Jean made this beautiful thing. And so tonight I arrived here, I go, Gene, you know, what do I do with this? And he's in the garage, like, teaching me, you know, how to hold it and give it to your right hand and then give it to your left hand, you know. And I realized that could describe 23 years of practice. You show up and they tell you, okay, go there, turn this way. No, turn the other. Oh, no, hold your hand. Now bow this way. Oh, this ceremony has this thing in it. Now, you know, you're memorizing new words on the fly, trying to remember everything. It's that beginner space of I don't really know. And I think there's an intelligent design behind this. Okay, so I used to just gripe about it. And now I'm thinking, there's some intelligent design here. Because the liturgy is complex, because every ceremony has a structure that's inherent in it, but they all vary so much, and everybody who's practiced here for any length of time has been sucked into being something, somewhere, for some ceremony, and you have to just step up and learn it, and you stand there shaking, your heart's pounding, and then it's fine. You know, and you just, over and over again, here I am, willing, just beginning, just learning for the first time, this ceremony, this practice, this offering. This offering tonight was different from any other offering. And it actually happened differently. If I came in, I was reviewing in my mind outside, okay, because I haven't been here in a while. You come in, you bow, you make your offering, and then I completely forgot that because I just got nervous about whether I was going to throw this across the room trying to bow. So I don't want to hurt anybody. Yeah. So just beginning, right? Just starting always, all the time in practice, just at the threshold all the time. And I think if there comes a point, and, you know, I mean, even ordination, you know, so Catherine and I talked about ordination for 10 years or something. Finally, she says, okay, let's do it. And I go, okay, great. So here, have 40 pounds of fabric to wear everywhere. And, you know, now you can't just bow. Now you have to put on a cloth, you know, and you have to do it this way. I mean, constantly, I feel like practice puts us in this beginner position. Always something new to adjust to or adapt to. Then the minute you adapt, well, there's something new. So, and it's a great gift. I guess that's the part I didn't realize before I was kneeling in the red room. I just got, oh, what a gift that I can actually still receive the little doily and all the little things that are happening in the room, even though it's a pretty overwhelming experience. You know, just physically walking into the energy of that, it could hijack the mind. But Zazen teaches us to just come back. Just come back. Just come back to this breath. Just come back to this pain. Just come back to this whatever it is. And then what I've learned, or what I'm still learning, and hope I'm always learning, is that if I do just come back, then now and then there is a spontaneous joy that just arises in me. I can't explain it, just like I can't explain a lot of the sadness I experience. I think my body is kind of a conduit for sadness. And all my life, I've been a recipient of, I believe, the sadness of the world. And I will just start weeping, you know, or just go around despondent for 3 days. Going, what's that? You know, I have a good life. I have no problem, but I'm really sad. And I just stopped explaining it. I just stopped trying to explain it because I realized that's what was off. Was trying to explain it. The sadness was just energy, and my body seems to pick it up in the world. So, okay, I can do that. And I learn to just be as much as I can with my own suffering. Always a beginner with my own sadness or my own suffering. But dropping the why about it was so important to me. And I think, you know, I think that this joy is like that. I'm not as familiar with it as I am with sadness. I know sadness. It's like an old friend when it comes, oh, okay, I know you. All right, let's go to work. You know, let's go to the dendo, whatever. Joy, I'm like, who's this now? But it just is a spontaneous thing, and it may or may not be connected with anything that's happening, actually. It just arises. And I think it is probably just part of the fabric that's there. And now I'm better able to connect with it. now and then, because I have a little bit more capacity to return. But I am always a beginner at that. Every time my mind flies off, you know, to wherever it goes, telling stories or whatever during Zazen, I go, okay, come back. I come back. It's just like it's the same old thing, but it's beginning again every time. And that's it. I mean, to me, I realized today, you know, if I could go through my life that way for the rest of my life, just seeing the little freshness in each moment, even if I can't explain it all or I can't even take it all in, it's so subtle, but just being present for it, regardless of what I remember or think or feel, or just being able to be present for it in a fresh way, with a fresh mind, a mind that's willing to meet it. What more? I mean, what more could I want in life than to be able to look back and say, this, you know, I met what I could meet with a fresh mind, because I learned to come back. I taught myself over and over and over again and again and again for the rest of my life how to come back. So when I started practice, that seemed like drudgery. These people were trying to kill me. What are you talking about? Come back to what? You know, I breathe all the time. You know, I mean, literally my teachers. Okay. So, I mean, really, they were paragons of patience, truthfully, every one of them. But, and they just kept, you know, smiling and kind of saying, oh, yeah, just, you know, just do it again. And just keep doing it. And literally, I would ask myself, so cognitive dissonance theory, for those of you who are psychology types, you'll know that cognitive dissonance theory predicts that I would fall in love with practice. Because even though it was trying to kill me, and I felt like it hated me and I hated it for about 16 years, I kept coming back. So there was a lot of dissonance about that, like, oh, what's wrong with me? I keep coming back for more of this, you know. But over time, I fell in love, and right here in this Zendo and in this community. And it's predictable, psychologically, actually, that would happen. But because the more you struggle with something, the more likely it is, actually, that you'll develop an affinity for it if you keep working with it. But it was more or less accidental, you know, it sort of happened. I never expected it. So what seemed like a drudgery 23 years ago when I first started my practice in Southern California now seems like the greatest gift life could offer. And if nothing more ever comes to me in my life but that I can return here, and start again, that's good enough. That is profound. And I think that's the most important thing that I kind of got in my body in the actual transmission ceremonies. I would like to also show you something that came out of the ceremonies that, you know, so as many of you who may have been here in the morning know, when you chant the ancestors, there is a list of male ancestors, about 93 or 4 of them. And then there is a list of women teachers. So these are women that we know in the record, in the historical record, existed, and we know when they lived approximately, and we have some idea from the historical record of their teaching. But unlike the men, where we have presumably an idea that this lineage was passed from one to the other of them, with the women, we don't have that continuity. So what we have are 60 or so names of women ancestors, women teachers, dating back to Mahapajapati, the first woman practitioner, who practiced with Buddha at the time of the Buddha. And they are not transmitted. It's not a lineage. their teachers. But it's not a lineage because, of course, just like in Christianity, women were basically written out of Buddhist history. In terms of actually passing the Dharma, we don't even know for sure until Hanyutara probably that women actually did do that. But anyway, so we have this list of teachers. So there's some confusion in the community now, in the Soto Zen. Maybe I'll even just narrow it further to the Suzuki Roshi lineage, because I don't know about other lineages what they're doing. But in our lineage, there's a little bit of uncertainty about what to do with this. There's a lot of willingness to include it in transmission, to have it be part of what is, sort of what goes on. But it's so new, this list, that there's not really an understanding of what do you do with it? We don't really transmit it because it's not a lineage. But I wanted to include it. I couldn't imagine myself receiving Dharma transmission without the women ancestors being part of that. So after several days, and my teacher is very open to this, so I'm not saying that he's not, he was very open to it. What I realized about 4 days in was he didn't know what to do with it. He had no idea what to do. So about third or fourth day, my colleague, Lisa, realized that we had these scraps of silk that had been given to us for practice, and each of us had only used a little bit of them, long, narrow silks. So she said, how about if we put the women on these? And I said, oh, that's a great idea. So we went up to talk to Tony about it, and he once we had a way to do it, an idea about it, he said, sure. So I would like to show you this. And I would like to show you this because I want the women in the room, and the men too, but I really want to speak here to the hearts of the women. I want you to know that this is, it exists, and these women are being, you are in this lineage. You are on these lineage charts. Your names are just different than you know them. But these women have gone before us. Now, the women who are on my lineage chart, actually, Blanche Hartman gave transmission to my teacher, Tony Patchell. So she is there. She appears now on the, along with the males, all the men, Blanche, you know. And there are several of them. I mean, there's many of those now. But it's amazing to me to see that it isn't until America. So we see India, we see China, we see Japan, and then in America we see women right in there along with the men. So, but I still think it's very, very important for women practicing to know that women have practiced the whole time. And here are some of their names. So we don't know all of them, but this is the little silk we made, and we put their names on a river. So there's no, like the men, there's a whole procedure for how to put the, where you write the men's names and in what forms, different forms that you write them in for different reasons. There's no understanding of that with the women. So because we had transmission at the Dragon River Temple, and because our silks were long and narrow, we made a river, and so here they are. And so these are the women that through whose names we remember all the women who have gone before us and who have practiced and made this practice possible for us. So if you'd like to look at this, I'll have it here. This is the Three Treasures stamp, which Tony affixed to it after we did the silks. We brought them to him, and he made them official by putting the Three Treasures stamp, and this is the Dragon River Temple stamp here, the chop of the Dragon River Temple. And so we started with an Enso. You can't use a bloodline like you do with the men because they're not heirs of each other. So we started with a red Enso. We made a red river. And then we ended with a black Enso. So beginningless and endless women practicing. And so I think you know, it's kind of unusual to show a silk, and this is not a transmitted silk. This is not a normal part of them. So I felt like I could, you know, be open with this. And I really thought it was important for the women in the room and also the men in the room to see that we are out there. We were there. Even though the history books don't say it very clearly, we were there. And we've always been there. And we've had to, you know, in some sense, knock on the door, pound on the door, throw our bodies against the door. Some of these women mutilated themselves so that they wouldn't be considered beautiful, so that they could practice in the monasteries, right, and not be a temptation to the men. So this is what's on this Red River. These are the lives on this Red River. They're not trivial lives. And I think it's really very moving to me that this was researched, that Grace Shearson really did the vast majority of this work. There are also some Vipassana practitioners that helped and have also done a lot of this. There are different lists. This isn't the only list, but this is the list that we are using. So I am showing it to inspire you and to show and just to say, you know, you are never alone. You are never alone. And when you read those books and you think, well, where there's no women, ever talked about. You know, Dogen had female students, but they didn't get written about for the most part. And so they were there. That we've always been there from the time of Buddha. And it's important that we're there, and it's important that we've always been there. It would be a very unusual and imbalanced practice to have only 49% of the population be able to enjoy it. So I'm very grateful to these women and to what they did to make this practice here and now, today, for us. And another reason this is so precious to me is because my teacher, Darlene, disappears in my lineage. Right, so on the chart, on the lineage chart, the formal lineage chart, it goes, she's not on there. Because Tony and she were in different lines. She received transmission from Michael Wanger and Tony from Blanche Hartman. So they had different parents, so to speak. And so I come from Tony now. So Darlene disappears from my lineage chart. Well, so she's here. And so Darlene is the last name before mine on this. And we brought these up and Tony actually added us, which was so sweet. But so that you know, for both Lisa and I, who had studied deeply with Darlene, it was very important to us to have her included in our documents. So that's another reason why it was so important. But I think just in general, you know, I recently had a practice discussion with Aya Anandabodhi, who is a bhikkhuni. That she was one of the five bhikkhunis that was ordained in England. So this is in Ajahn Chah's lineage, and they refused to ordain women or to recognize women. Even though women had been practicing with them, they refused to ordain them. Finally, a monk came along who was willing to ordain these five women, and they had to run away. They had to leave the country. They were endangered, literally. So three of them now live in San Francisco. And I met one of them at Hartford Street Zen Center. And so I went and talked with her. And, you know, she said, it's a ridiculous thing to imagine that, you know, there were bhikkhunis in the Buddha's time. And then they don't exist. They're not allowed. And now in the 21st century appears five bhikkhunis fully ordained. It's very beautiful. And it provides a fullness of practice, a fullness of realization that the whole human body is part of this. We don't exclude half. We include all. So I think these women are really devoting their lives to this this knowing that it's a whole picture. practice is about all of us, and their ordination and their willingness to take that risk is important to all of us, not just women, but all practitioners who have been run out of countries, starved, you know, imprisoned, and so on, in everywhere in the world practically. And these women stepped in and said, "We want the whole Sangha represented, not just one part of it." So these are powerful actions happening today.